step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi everybody, it's Mark Johns here once again with the Ice Cream for the Soul Blog Talk Radio Show. And I'm very happy to have a returning guest. I spoke to Ian Watson about, I just checked before we came on the air actually how long ago it was. It was September of last year I spoke to Ian. And Ian's going to be, last week's conversation was with Gabriela Maldonado Montano, who's going to be part of the Viva event here in Spain. And Ian Watson is also, I'm looking forward to, I've met Ian, but I've never actually worked with him as such or spent time with him when he's been strutting his free principle stuff. So I'm looking forward to spending time with Ian here in Spain. And for those of you who don't know about Ian, Ian's an author, trainer, consultant, and he's been interested in the field of mental health since 1988. He's written numerous books and articles. And I've just been speaking to him about this, actually. He holds retreats around the world. He's been to Greece, Czech Republic, Canada, Croatia, Finland, Bulgaria, the UK, Ireland. And he's just told me that before he comes to Spain, he's off to Egypt. So he's a bit of a globetrotter with his work. And now he exclusively works with the three principles, understanding. And I'm especially looking forward to speaking to Ian again because I always enjoy my conversations, but over the last couple of years, I've had a few conversations that have really touched me. Like I said, I don't want to dilute any of the other conversations, but there was two people who I was touched by were Carol Burrows and Bernie Gillespie, and they've both spent a lot of time with you, Ian, haven't they? So something must be rubbing off on them. So anyway, welcome, Ian. How are you doing?
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be back here. Yeah, I don't know which direction the rubbing off is happening, but I think I'd say it's mutual.
Right, well, yeah, I think I understand that. But it's just, it's interesting now we learn from each other with this when we get in the zone, isn't it?
Definitely.
So would you just like to just tell people what you've been up to over the last 12 months? Just a brief rundown of what you've been doing since I last spoke to you? And if anything
sure.
You do in your sharing, for example?
Yeah, it's nice to kind of check in again. You know, as you just said, it's been a year or so.
Yeah.
And what I love about this work, and you probably find something similar, I'm sure a lot of people do in this field, is that on the face of it, we're, you know, I'm still in the same field. I'm still really doing the same work. I work a lot with groups, doing ongoing trainings and also one-off workshops and retreats, and I also do one-to-one work with clients. That hasn't changed, so you know the kind of outer form of it doesn't change. But I think what does, let's say, evolve rather than change is what we bring to that work. And I'd like to think that it gets simpler. We get capable of getting out of our own way a little more effectively. And what it looks like to me at the moment is that, and this is probably the homeopath in me speaking, is that the less we do, the more effective the work is, really. Mm-hmm. And I think that the topic that was on my mind when you were asking me, you know, what would be nice to talk about, I, the word that came to me was the word presence. And that's just something that's been kind of around in my awareness in recent weeks or months, and recognizing just the importance of that and really the significance of that, because it's the word that, you know, we use in a lot of different ways and settings. But I think we probably underestimate, or I have underestimate, that presence is really, to me, one way of talking about what this is all about, what it's all about. It's what it all kind of leads to, and it's also what we're in the business of uncovering. And it's also what we bring to the work. You know, essentially what we have is our own presence. You know, what that's really, to me, that's what we have that speaks to other people, that touches other people. And hopefully in that, you know, in that conversation, in that sharing that we do in this work, it helps to evoke the presence in whoever it is that's in the room with us. That's how it's looking to me, Mark.
I'm just loving the synchronicity of things at the moment, because like Ian just said, and before you came on the air, you mentioned, before I pressed record, you mentioned that, and that's been very much, and we hadn't spoke about this beforehand, but that's been very much in my mind lately, and it's even been coming up in previous conversations. That you mentioned my conversation with Muji before we came on the air, and if people heard me talking with Dickin a few weeks ago, they will have heard that moment when I nearly lost it and started crying almost as we was talking about presence. So I'm really happy to explore this with you tonight, and let's see where it goes. And I'm totally with you on this. I'm seeing, I don't facilitate too much. This is mainly what I'm doing with these. I have these conversations with people who are doing amazing work like yourself, and occasionally with Sheila, and in groups I do facilitate. But I'm noticing the more I get out of the way, and when I say I mean Mark with all his ideas of how this should be delivered or shared or whatever terms you want to put on trying to give this understanding to people or help people get a grasp of this, the more I can be quiet, the more that presence seems to be there. And when I say quiet, I'm just thinking about, like we say, the egoic ideas of how I want things to go beforehand. I'm just curious how, if that equates to how you're seeing things at the moment, Ian.
Very much so. And I think, I mean, I enjoyed very much the talk, that the recording that you did with Muji. Mm-hmm. Who I've not met Muji, but I've heard many of his recordings and watched some of his things on YouTube and so on. And to me, he really speaks from that place to that place.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this came up in our previous conversation, Mark, but I had the pleasure of spending time with Papaji.
Yes, you did mention it briefly. Yeah. I'd love to hear more about that.
let's start there, because listening to that talk with Muji, he obviously talks about Papaji, who was really the teacher that helped him to come to the place, you know, the understanding that he reached.
Yeah.
And it was probably, would it be back in about 1991, 1992, something like that. I went to India. And I was recommended by a teacher. Here's an example of presence for me, how this works, because I'd been training, I trained as a homeopath, as you probably remember.
Yeah.
And that had become my work. And I had a variety of teachers, some really good teachers in my homeopathic training. And one of the things that stood out for me was what the teachers brought to the subject other than their knowledge. If that makes sense. You know, what did they bring of themselves? What did they bring of their humanness, if you like? And there was one teacher who I was particularly fond of. His name was Murray Feldman. And he had what I would call a presence. And to me, there was something that Murray had, which I was interested in.
Yeah.
And it was difficult for me to name what it was exactly, but there was a certain serenity and a certain, let's call it a spiritual perspective on life, which he brought to the table, which interested me. So over time, I got to know him better. We became friends and stayed in touch after I left the homeopathy school. And it transpired that Murray had been a long, long student of Papaji's. He'd known Papaji in India for many years before he was particularly well known. Mm. And he'd recommended him to me many times. And it wasn't really the fact that, you know, he was telling me this would be an interesting person to visit. It was more who Murray was that impressed me. Mm. And just because of that, I thought, yeah, I'm going to go. I'm going to go and see Papaji. Mm. But it was one of those things that, you know, I didn't get around to. You know, I got busy. Yeah. I was doing my practice and so on and so forth. And I also got, you know, I was still following other, I don't want to call them other teachers or paths, but anything that interested me, I would go and check it out. And I was always interested in spiritual pursuits. And just a few examples that occurred to me just as I was reflecting before I came on the call. I remember I was living in Cumbria at the time in the Lake District, north of England. Mm. And one day I heard about a guy who was coming to give a talk. He was a local acupuncturist. And he'd organized a Tibetan Lama to come and give a talk. And I think it was supposed to be about the Tibetan healing. Hmm. Now the Lama came and there was a small group of us sat in this room. And this Lama entered. I'd never seen a Tibetan Lama before. So
I didn't know what, in itself, I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect. And in a way it was a bit incongruous. We were sat in this acupuncturist room, you know, in the north of England. Right. And this guy arrives and he looked like he'd just got off the plane from Tibet. He had his yak skin boots on and, you know,
really
his top of Buddhist robes and everything. And he was a hunk of a man. It was like a tree. It was like an oak tree.
Right.
I remember him walking into the room and, my God, did he have a presence. Mm. And of course, I mean, he didn't speak any English. So I didn't understand anything he was saying. He had a translator who probably managed with about 50% of the translation. but it didn't matter because this guy, he just came in and he sat in the room and something emanated from him that was powerful. It was impactful. And I remember being just very moved by the whole experience, you know, having a clue what he was saying. But there was something about him that you could really feel, or I could really feel. What I don't know is whether, you know, how other people experienced it, but I should say that I could really feel that. So again, this, you know, this sense of a presence was something that was, on the one hand, quite intangible, on the other hand, something quite real and recognizable. Now, some years later, actually, it may have even been sooner. I probably got the sequence wrong now. It's a long time ago, about 30 years ago. But I remember I'd heard about Krishnamurti.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I love Krishnamurti's work, yeah.
Yeah, this was Jiddu Krishnamurti, whose books I'd been studying. His writings I thought were wonderful. They were just beautifully clear, and there was something very direct and clear. And I heard that he was giving these public talks in England, in Hampshire, and I decided on a whim I was gonna go and listen. So I hitchhiked and took me about a couple of days to get there. And it was in Hampshire,
no,
somewhere
when?
In Hampshire.
What time period are we talking? I'm just curious.
Similar sort of time, early 90s.
Okay, right, like. Okay, yeah, cool.
Now, this was interesting to me because I had a lot of ideas in my mind about this guy, you know.
Yeah.
And because I held him in a kind of certain kind of esteem in my own mind, I imagined that all the people who followed him would be, you know, very nice, spiritual people, you know, very kind, welcoming. Obviously, I was making this up, but this was my fantasy, having never been to such a gathering before. And it was a big gathering. It was like a three-day event, and people came from all over the shop, and everybody was camping or staying in camper vans or what have you. Right. I had my little one-man tent.
Okay. That sounds like me. I mean, I was at Muji's place. I was in a tent. Anyway, go on, sorry.
There you go. It was summer, but it was the English summer, so the weather was terrible.
So you're freezing, yeah.
Yeah. Not only that, it was pouring down. It was absolutely pouring down. I arrived late. So everybody else was already, you know, they'd already found their spot. And I remember at first, I was surprised because every time I tried to pitch my tent, someone would come out and tell me to move on, that there wasn't room. People were so unfriendly. You know, the first people that I encountered were so unfriendly, and I felt so disappointed. You know, my images of what spiritual people would be like were being shattered one by one. Anyway, I ended up a sort of damp, soggy corner of the field. You know, it was nobody else wanted to park in.
Yeah.
They'd get stuck. So I pitched up there, and I went to the talks, and each morning Krishnamurti would come and he'd sit on this barren stage. He'd just sit on this wooden chair and he would just start talking. Again, I hadn't the faintest idea. He was speaking English, but still I hadn't the faintest idea what he was talking about. He had a presence.
Mm-hmm.
He had a presence. Mm-hmm. And it was undeniable. You know, he was a small man compared to this Tibetan Lama, but when he started speaking, it was as if something else came through him. That's the best way that I can put it. You know, he didn't have any notes. I would be 100% sure that he didn't rehearse anything. He just sat down and he began to speak, and then he would take questions later. To be honest, I left feeling somewhat dejected, because I don't know what I expected, but whatever it was, it wasn't fulfilled.
Okay.
So after that, I started thinking about what my friend Murray had said. You know, if you're going to go see a spiritual teacher, go to India and see Papaji.
Yeah.
So this was back on my mind, you know.
Yeah.
I thought, all right, maybe it's time. And
it's a fair way to go, though, India, isn't it?
It's a long way to go, and to me, it was a scary place, and it was completely going into the unknown. But an interesting thing happened. I had a trip to Egypt. Mm. I've been going to Egypt for many years, and I went to Egypt on a teaching trip. I was teaching homeopathy out there. While I was there, I had what I can describe as a terrifically powerful waking dream, which the likes of which I'd never had before. Mm. So it was as if somebody appeared to me in the bedroom. And I don't normally see things like that. I've met many people who do, but I felt energies and things of this kind, but I've never actually seen someone appear when my eyes were open.
Right.
And this is what happened. This guy appeared to me. I was white. I was fully awake, even though it was dark. And he looked like an Oriental type. I couldn't say exactly where from. I guess probably from Egypt or the Middle East.
Yeah.
And he was pointing, and I somehow knew that he was pointing in the direction of India.
Right.
And he said to me, these were his only words, "It's time for you to go."
Right. Okay.
And then he disappeared, and I was literally in a cold sweat,
because right.
I didn't quite know what I'd seen, or, you know, I thought, did I just hallucinate that? Was that for real?
It was very clear, as if somebody actually was in the room, right?
It was as if the person was there in the room, and he said, "It's time for you to go," and that was it. I came straight home and booked the trip to India. And as anyone who has been to India will know, that, you know, it's the beginning of a big adventure, which it was indeed. But I made my way finally to Lucknow, where Papaji lived, and I was lucky to spend about a couple of weeks with him, and. Because my friend had known him for many years, he'd sent a letter of introduction. So he kind of welcomed me into his home. I got to spend time with him in his home and everything. And
oh, wow.
He was, you know, he was just such a, I think at that time he must have been about 81, 82. It wasn't that long before he passed away. And he was like a mischievous child. You know, he was just having fun. And yet, at certain moments, He could just turn to any of the group of people who were around him, and with a sudden question, or, you know, just a sudden few words that would literally stop you in your tracks. But it was all done with such good humor, and you know, he was just laughing the whole time. We would spend the whole time laughing. Really, it was just beautiful experience. And if you said to me, well, what did you learn there? Or, you know, what did you get from it? Or, you know, did you get enlightened? I would have to say no. I really didn't. However, something interesting happened. When I first got there, I was very freaked out by India.
Oh, yeah.
I was. Really, like,
is that the poverty you mean and stuff? Or
the people had told me about the poverty and the, you know, how just what an assault on the senses India was going to be. And yeah, all of that was true. And I was somewhat prepared for that, but still, you're not fully prepared.
No.
But it was more the, what was interesting for me was I got to know some people, including people living on the streets, you know, beggars, people who'd have leprosy and so forth. When you're staying in one place for a while, they quickly kind of, you know, people latch onto you.
Yeah, especially Westerners, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, of course. And so some of them start to feature in your daily life, you know, they become people that you actually start to have some kind of a connection with or a relationship with.
Hmm.
And I remember at first just how scared I was, you know, I was just scared and I could hardly sleep, you know, every kind of noise was potentially dangerous to me.
Boy, you're not Northern lad, are you?
I know, it all went out the window very quickly in India. So I remember one night, I'd been awake for hours and hours and I was so tired, and eventually I finally fell asleep. And then in the middle of the night, there's this banging on the door as if someone's trying to break the door down.
Mm.
And I was just, you know, I was praying. And I was so frightened. I just wanted this person to go away. And if I called, you know, there was no voice coming, just more knocking. Right. Eventually I opened the door. There's a little lad there with a tea urn trying to, you know, selling me some chai. And I'd been terrified, you know, for about half an hour. This poor little boy just wanted to sell me some tea. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, you know. So that was India for me. It was just doing my head in.
Yeah.
But I remember I'd made friends with this guy from Holland who'd been staying around Papaji for, I think, several years, as I recall. We became friends. He kind of adopted me. So my first impressions were good because the people were much friendlier than the people had been around Krishnamurti. That was the first thing I noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that's interesting because, you know, I think any kind of spiritual movement, whoever is the, let's say, the figurehead, you know, the originator, the founder, whatever, I think in some way they set the tone.
Yeah.
You know, they set the kind of template. And there was, in my experience, and this is only my experience, there was a coldness to Krishnamurti.
Yeah.
That's how I experienced him. And now his teaching was undoubtedly brilliant, but I never saw him smile.
Yeah.
Really, I never saw him smile. There was something very serious about him. I would even use the word humorless.
Although right, yeah.
I'm already going on my own experience.
And but the that's interesting, isn't it, for somebody who's so wise, as you would say, or awake. Because, like say, you tend to put, like you said, you tend to put that hand in hand with the lovingness or warmth, don't you?
I suppose so, yeah. And so the contrast when I arrived at where Papaji was living couldn't be greater, because I got a warm welcome from everyone, including Papaji himself. And this young guy who kind of adopted me, and he found me a place to stay, and he was showing me, you know, who I could buy food from without getting too sick, you know. You need that kind of help, you know.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And After my probably initial, let's say, week or week and a half, I remember walking down the street with this friend. I forget his name now, but we were walking together and we were in the same neighborhood that we'd been in the whole time. And I just turned to him quite spontaneously and I said, "It's so peaceful here, isn't it?" And he burst out laughing. I said, "What are you laughing at?" He said, "Have you heard what you just said?" I said, "What do you mean?" You know, just commenting how peaceful it is. He said, "Have you forgotten how many times you've complained about the noise?" And not only had I forgotten, I didn't even notice that what I thought was a really hideously crazy, noisy place had suddenly become peaceful in my eyes.
I totally can relate. Yeah.
And that really got my attention, because on the surface, it looked like I was just hanging around Papaji having a nice time. You know, we were having a laugh and drinking a lot of chai and so on. I didn't notice that something in me was getting very still and very calm. And it was happening just by itself, completely unnoticed. And it was only that particular incident that suddenly highlighted that to me, that something in me had actually shifted. And I was really struck by it. Because it was so unexpected, you know, and there was nothing that I'd done to make that happen. There wasn't even anything directly that I knew that Papaji had done to make that happen. It just seemed to be happening.
There's so much in that I can relate to. You heard the conversation I had with Muji, and he had he was very struck with Papaji when he first met him. I think he more or less said, I knew I met the Buddha. I think that's kind of the words he came out with. I was kind of struck right when the very first time I met Muji in person, when he walked in the room, I actually think I said this on the conversation with him. It was very noticeable, the energy that, I found it difficult to put into words, but it just had such a presence about him that it was almost as if he was emanating love. And being a fellow northerner, I can imagine some of my old friends thinking, what's this guy? What's he talking about? All this love stuff. But it literally, I can't put another word on it. It was like presence with love. And basically one and the same thing I see him anyway. And I think I was hearing very much in what you just said. Like you said, put your finger on what was happening, but you suddenly found that peaceful, felt you were in a peaceful place. And I'm just seeing more and more that there's. I think Sid Banks said this more or less right from the beginning when I first heard him talking about you're looking for a feeling, I think we put so much. Importance on intellectual understanding, where there's stuff gets through to us, or perhaps it's probably better to say stuff comes out of us. The more we relax, who we are really just comes to the surface, and that doesn't need to be done with the intellect, does it?
That's it. That's lovely. I love that. I love that you corrected yourself there. It's like the stuff that comes out of us. And that to me is that is more akin to what this work is about, and it's like we're shedding whatever it is that's been kind of encasing and encrusting this love and this presence that is our nature, that is our birthright, and that doesn't belong to any of us personally. It's that which is the ground of being that we all share.
And I've been hearing these terms like presence and ground of being and being in the now and all this from the very first time I'd probably got impacted by the first spiritual book I picked up. But it's amazing each day that goes by, I'm probably exaggerating by saying it day by day, but I just find it so wonderful that the words mean more to me. I feel there's more of an understanding when I hear you talk about the ground of being and presence, and it just seems to be more clarity around that. But I think there's many people who probably hear this conversation who would have no idea what we're talking about as well, aren't there?
Well, you know, I think that's a great point, Mark, but here's what I'm finding more and more.
Yeah.
People will often start off by saying something like what you just said. I was actually with a small group on the weekend in Yorkshire. It was the first time I was talking about the principles in my native county, which was a real treat. And we had a small group together, and I was talking about this fact that to me is a fact that we've all touched base at different points in our life.
Yeah.
Where we found that, let's call it that ground of being, or we found that connection. We might use different words to describe it,
yeah.
But we've had, at least for a moment, we've had an experience of coming home, if you want to put it that way, or just being us, being ourself, or just as Dickon likes to talk about it, dropping out of our personal thinking,
yeah,
and falling into something which is less personal and yet is much more real, in a sense, something much more sustaining and something much more beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sharing this point, and I was sharing some experiences from my own life where these moments had just, you know, had occurred for me. And somebody raised the point, said, well, I can't remember ever feeling that kind of connection. I can't remember ever feeling myself to be a part of something greater.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the different ways that I was talking about it, this person was saying, I can't relate.
Hmm.
And I said to her, well, have you ever had the experience of just being really closely connected with one other person, for example, just for a moment? And she reflected on that, and suddenly, she didn't share the example, but suddenly I could see that she remembered.
Yeah.
Something just popped into her mind, and with it, she was deeply moved. Because she suddenly got a very strong memory of a time when she had been with someone, and there had been that kind of dissolving of the sense of separate selves.
Yeah.
And what was lovely was that she suddenly recognized, she, even though this example that she was recollecting was only to do with one person, what she said was, oh, that's the same, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's the same. And I said, yeah, and that was it. You know, she couldn't actually say anything more about it. When she tried to speak about it, she lost words. Which I said, that's it. That's how you know you're onto it.
Yeah, and I'm so glad I asked you that. I had a similar conversation. We went in the similar direction when I was speaking to Carol, and I kind of said a similar thing to her, that people haven't found it hard to understand what you're talking about. But then, like you just said very clearly, I think, it's, we don't notice those moments, or we just kind of gloss over them. Or it's like we've all had moments, well, probably a sweeping statement, where the beauty of a sunset will stop us in our tracks. I'm not saying every beautiful sunset, because sometimes we're in a rush and we don't see it, but there'll be sometimes where there's that, it stops you, and you're in a moment of awe. And I think that's a similar kind of, well, it is to me, it's just part and parcel of the same thing, that just moment of presence, of actually taking in and recognizing what's around you, your part, that we are part of in many ways. Well, not in many ways, I just see it very clear that we are just part of the everything.
Yeah, you're right. And I do believe that everybody has had moments, but I also find that we forget them, you know. We do forget, but we haven't really fully forgotten.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take much. I think when we have kind of the eyes and ears for that, then we can help a person to remember. And one of the things I love about the Sufi tradition, which I've got many friends in Egypt and other places who are Sufis, mm. which is the mystical heart of Islam.
Mm.
And one time, in fact, I was introduced to a Sufi sheikh, who would be like the Sufi master. And I was asked if I would treat him homeopathically, because he was old and he had various ailments. And I said, of course, it would be my pleasure. And this fellow drove me several hours through the desert from Cairo. And we went to this little shanty town, and I got to meet this old chap. Again, he was in his 80s. He was arthritic. His eyes were kind of cataracts. You know, he wasn't sure whether he could actually see anything or not.
Mm.
But he sat down with us, and despite his frail physical form, again, I could feel his presence.
Mm.
And when he started to speak to me, he was speaking in Arabic. The fellow who'd driven me there was translating. And as he was speaking to me, again, even though I couldn't understand the words directly, it was really touching me. You know, there was something really stirring inside me as this chap was talking. And at one point, I just felt my whole chest was just filling up. And I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. It felt like both would be appropriate. You know?
Yeah.
And what was funny, he'd been asking me several questions. I'll tell you the questions he was asking me, because it was kind of amusing. He, when I'd finished, you know, I took a little kind of case history and I prescribed him some homeopathic medicines. Right. And then he said, you know, would it be okay if I asked you some questions? I said, of course. And he said to me, does it sometimes happen that the medicine that you give doesn't work? Mm. And I said, yeah, more often than I would like, you know. And he said, well, what do you do then? I said, well, we have these books that we consult, you know, we maybe look for a better remedy. And if that doesn't work, what do you do? Mm. I said, well, you know, we have professional colleagues and, you know, I probably would phone a friend, you know, and see what my colleague would suggest. And again, he's looking at me through these, you know, these cataract eyes, very gentle, but very persistent. And he says, well, and if that doesn't work, what would you do? And I was, you know, I was getting a bit hot under the collar by this point, you know, and I thought, well, he's asking me a genuine question. It deserves a, you know, an honest answer. So I reflected on it and I told him the truth, which was, I said, well, you know, I ask for help. And it's just something that I had kind of learned to do ever since I've been in the healing work. If I got stuck or I fell out of my depth, I would literally just ask for help. Mm. Usually inwardly, you know, nobody else would know that I was asking for help. Yeah. But I would, you could say, offer a prayer, or just I would ask for some kind of guidance, or, you know, show me a sign kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said that to him. I said, well, you know, if I really get stuck, I kind of hand it over and I ask for help. Again, he looks me in the eye. His final question, he says, to whom do you ask? And at that point, I felt like he had me pinned down in the corner, you know? And he was just sat there, this gentle, elderly, frail-looking character with this very benign smile on his face. Each question, it felt like it, you know, he pinned another limb of mine to the wall. You know?
Okay.
And when he asked me that one, I was finished. I couldn't speak.
Really?
I knew if I tried to speak, all that would come out was tears, and I just had like these waves of love and whatever it was that was just coming through me. I was completely bewildered. At this point, He relaxed. He kind of smiled. He kind of half laughed. Rubs his hands together and he says, "No more questions."
That's a beautiful story. Then.
That was it. He was done with me. You know.
Yeah.
I might be staying obvious, or I might be getting the wrong end of the stick. So, would you say he'd invited you into a state of presence there? Invited you, or just helped you into a state of presence, and you just... I'm just curious how... It was just kind of how... When you said if you'd have opened your mouth, there would have been tears. I've kind of had those experiences myself in similar ways. And it could be equated with, like you say, the realization of... What is, in many ways, what is behind everything?
It felt like it'd taken away anything that I was kind of clinging to that I didn't really need. I just thought I needed. That's what it felt like. It felt like, you know, if you've been relying on some kind of crutches or whatever, he'd been knocking them away one at a time, and suddenly there was nothing left. And It was like he'd thrown me back on myself, but on an aspect of myself that it wasn't that I didn't know was there, but it wasn't where I was normally hanging out.
Yeah,
let's put it that way. And yeah, you could say he invited. I could use the word persuaded. I don't know. Somehow he just gently nudged me until there was nowhere else that I could go.
Mm.
And so I just found myself dropping into that inward place that once I landed there, it was beautiful. And of course, I didn't want to go anywhere else. And yet at the same time, my intellect, the ego mind, was completely scrambled. Completely scrambled. I didn't know what to make of this fellow, you know. So on the one hand, my mind was coming up with all kinds of nonsense. And yet, on the other hand, I was just completely, completely at peace. And I felt myself just to be filling up. It was as if I was just filling up with spiritual nourishment.
It strikes me then that if you or any of, or myself or anybody who's sharing the understanding of the three principles, in many ways that's where we're trying to get the people themselves, isn't it? Like that same place that that wise old man took you or brought you back to, should I say.
I guess that's true, and I'm hesitating.
Yeah.
And I suppose the hesitation is that, in a way, it's not for us to get anyone anywhere.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and I know you know that.
Yeah.
But that to me is part of the paradoxical nature of this work, is that on the one hand, yeah, that's exactly, you know, that in a way that's the most beautiful experience that any of us can have, is just to have the things that we've been clinging to that are not real fall away, and for us to momentarily, at least, just to fall back into something which we can really trust, you know, something which feels really secure and really safe and really loving. It's a beautiful thing, and anyone who's touched that for themselves quite naturally wants to share that. I think it's just a natural thing for us that we want to invite other people to the party, you know.
Yeah.
I say to people, you know, there's a reason why Sydney Banks spent the second half of his life sharing, relentlessly sharing, and you know, inviting people to initially to his home and then to the talks that he gave. You know, he could have become a hermit and, you know, had a nice life quietly by himself, but he didn't. And to me, that is part of what this brings for us. It brings a desire to share what we ourselves have experienced. And yet at the same time, we know that we can't impose it. We can't impose it, and we can't force it upon anybody. And any hint of us contaminating that with our own desire to change someone, you know, or to influence a person or to push somebody to a place that they themselves are not ready to go.
Yeah.
You know, immediately we're going to lose whatever sense of peace and connection we had, and we're going to stop being of service to other people. So it's you know, it's a kind of, it's a razor edge kind of business.
That just came to mind before you said it, that old saying I think there's a saying about that, the path of truth is a razor hedge, and I think that's so much to this. It's like, if you go one way, you can be seen as you're trying to force something onto somebody, and if you go the other way, it's but it's a beautiful, when you find yourself on that razor's edge, if you want to put it like that, it's kind of beautiful.
It's the best. But you know, one of the things I like to point out to people is the fact that you don't have to go to India, or, you know, I consider myself extremely fortunate that I've been able to travel and be introduced to some remarkable individuals and to get to spend time with them. But I could equally talk about, and I'd like to, if it's okay with you, Mike, I'd like to talk about some other moments where I feel that quite spontaneously I've landed in a similar place. And it hasn't been, you know, I wouldn't have called those moments part of my spiritual quest.
I'd be very interested to hear about those, yeah.
Early ones that I can remember was when I was a school kid, and I grew up in Yorkshire. And when I was in my, I would say probably early teens, let's say about 13, 14, we had a school trip into the Yorkshire Dales, and we were going to hear a poet read some of his poems. And the poet was Ted Hughes.
Oh, right.
who subsequently, after that time, he became what's known as the poet laureate, you know, which is like the kind of king poet of the country for a while.
Was Ted Hughes the guy who wrote The Iron Man, or am I getting mixed up? Anyway, sorry,
I don't know. He could well have. He could well have done. Yeah. He was, I mean, he was particularly known for his nature poems.
Okay.
He wrote a whole series about crows that I remember very distinctly. And I only remember one of the poems that he recited on this particular occasion. It was about a fox. And, you know, at that age, I didn't really know what poetry was for, you know, what it was about, what it was supposed to do. And me and my mates were kind of messing around, you know, we just thought it was a good excuse for a day off school, you know. And yet I remember going to this village hall, and Ted Hughes, like Krishnamurti years later, he just came into this very fairly barren setting, sat on a wooden chair and started to speak. And he recited one of his poems. And I remember, you know, whatever messing about we were doing, boy, did we get quiet quick when he started talking.
Really?
Yeah. This man had a presence.
Yeah.
And it really, really touched something in me. Mm. And I've been a lifelong fan of Ted Hughes' work ever since. Mm. And I don't remember the words that he used, but it was just something that he brought to that room. He was a formidable human being. It was like a force of nature in the room somehow. And it felt like he contained the energies of the natural world and somehow bottled them, you know, encapsulated them into his poetry. And then out it came.
Beautiful. Mm.
And it was incredible. And for me, it was the second most moving experience I'd had. The previous one had happened when I was 7 or 8 years old, which I may have told you in our previous talk, where I'd just been walking on the moorland with some friends, and suddenly I found myself in some long grass, and it appeared to me like that grass was just shimmering as if it was alive. And I suddenly just found myself to be blissfully happy for no good reason. And I didn't want to leave. You know, I felt like if I shouted for my friends, it would break the spell, you know?
Yeah.
And it was like I just fell out of time. And I remember the feeling was just complete elation. And I had no idea how that happened or where it came from. But I mistakenly associated it with the place that I was, you know?
Yeah. So
I went back there years later. So for years, I was looking for that patch of grass, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, I could never quite—I couldn't quite get the feeling back, because
you're looking
now, now I know I was looking in the wrong place. But at that time, it made sense. So there was something when Ted Hughes came, it was like an echo of that feeling. It was like, oh, there it is again.
It's recognition, isn't there, of something? That's present.
There it is again. And for me, it's frequently had these elements of being of nature. Somehow a connection of being in nature. And many people will say that, you know, if you ask people, where do you just find yourself being most at peace, most relaxed? People will very, very frequently say, you know, when I'm out walking the dog, when I'm in the hills, when I'm by the sea. I had some years later, when I was still living in Cumbria, I was going through a very, very difficult period. I could probably say I was depressed. I was really struggling. And I remember I couldn't get anything done because my head was just full of noise, you know. So in despair, I just put everything down, got in the car, and I drove to the bottom of Coniston Water, which is one of the lovely lakes there. And I started climbing up the hill. There's a path that I'd done a few times, but I hadn't been there for a while. And I got up to a certain height, and there's a place where once you got to a certain height, you'd go above the tree line, and suddenly there would be this vista would open up. You can see all the way across the lake. You know, it's beautiful. It was a crisp autumn day, blue sky, autumn colours on the lake, you know. So it was working its magic on me. It was calming me down a little bit. And normally I would stop at that place, turn around and come back. That's exactly what I'd intended to do. And I found myself walking the opposite direction. And so I realized I'm going further uphill, you know, and it's going to get dark soon. And is this a good idea? You know, again, my mind's kicking in. But despite my concerns, I just felt compelled that I'm just going to keep going, at least until I get around that next corner, which I couldn't see beyond. And I kept going, and I'd never gone that far on this particular track. There was no one else around. I didn't see a soul. It was as if something was pushing me. And I got around that corner, and as soon as I came around the corner, there he was. There was an almighty red stag. Gigantic male deer stood on the path in front of me, looking down at me. I mean, he was huge. He was huge. I didn't even come up to his haunches, you know. Never seen one before that close in my life. And again, it was like the Tibetan Lama, you know, presence. And that animal, it just looked me in the eye. It didn't appear to be afraid. It didn't turn and run. Strangely, I wasn't afraid either. I was just, what happened was it just completely threw me out of all my petty concerns, you know, everything that had been troubling me for days and weeks, all just fell away. It was amazing. It was like a complete shift in perspective. And that stag just stared me out for about a minute and a half, and then it just very slowly turned around and wandered off, as if it, you know, as if it had done it finished with me, you know. Again, it had that feeling of I'm done with you.
Yeah. And that's your lesson for today, or whatever.
Was it? You know, and I came down, and I was skipping down that hill. You know, I'd got up with my head was hanging low, and my mind was full of cares and worries and anxiety. I came down. I was rejuvenated. I was replenished. And I felt like I had, you know, this strength. Suddenly, this strength, I'd been invigorated somehow. And that for me was just another example of how the different forms that this can take. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, increasingly I started to develop the suspicion that it's always just around the corner.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And even closer than around the corner.
Yeah, it's here now, yeah.
It's here now. It's the only variable is our degree of receptivity in the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'll share something briefly with you that just reminded me when you were talking. And when I was 17, I probably had something that I could really felt. I was conscious of being like, I can look back, I wouldn't have called it this at the time, but it was like a very strong spiritual experience. It was just a beautiful moment of wow, just being blown away by the space I was in. And it was the very first time I saw Bruce Springsteen in concert.
Yes.
And it was, and it, of course, he's not everybody's cup of tea, but he's still around now after decades and decades, so he's obviously doing something right. But there is such, he had such a presence on stage, and you could see there was so much joy. Where he was coming from, he wasn't doing his job. He was just being. And I wouldn't have put it like that at the time, but now I can understand that it's such a beauty when somebody's present. I think I said this with when I recently spoke to Dickie, and I said this as well when I spoke to Muji. There's a recognition there, and it's funny. I had a friend of mine over who some people would he would laugh at this statement, but some people would call him a self-realized man. Paul, a friend of mine. And he was a great footballer. And I said to him, I told him about this story, and he smiled. And I said, in many ways, like Springsteen was like my first guru. And he said, oh, George Best was mine. And I totally knew what he meant, because, you know, them moments when, I know he had his issues in other areas of life, but when he was on the football, he was totally present, not saying all the time. And there's just a beauty in that, when somebody's present in what they're doing.
That's it. I'm getting goosebumps as you're talking there, Mark, because it's so true what you're saying, and this is why these individuals in different fields, it's why they become like the heroes, you know, like the folk heroes, because even though they're, you know, they're in an occupation which is shared by many, many thousands, people recognize that this one is touching a place that not everybody's touching. And they're drawn to it. We're all drawn to it. It's, you know, it has a kind of gravitational pull for us. And as you say, for one person, it could be that it's the sports field that really captures them.
Yeah.
And for someone else, it could be music. For someone else, it could be the arts.
Yeah.
I can remember standing in front of Matt Rothko's paintings in, I think it was in New York, I forget where. And, you know, I'd read a little bit about them and so on, but suddenly being in the presence of some of those paintings, oh my God, there it was again, you know, stopped me in my tracks. I can remember being in Northern California, walking in the Redwood Forest. You come across the giant sequoias, you know, these majestic trees, and you know, for a while you can hear noises of people and there's dogs barking, and then all of a sudden it feels like you've crossed a threshold. I can remember it as if it had just happened, and this is maybe 15 years ago I was there. It's like you've stepped into a cathedral, and suddenly you feel compelled to look skyward because these trees are so damn tall, you know, you can't see anything from the ground. So it kind of lifts you, you know, it elevates your spirits, just like the cathedrals are designed to do in the way they were built. And yet it's a natural phenomena. And you find yourself, you know, you're taking a sharp intake of breath somehow. And it's intriguing to me, you know, that word inspiration. It has to do with breath, you know, to inspire, to take in breath, and it also has to do with being inspired, which means we get elevated to another plane, to another level. And that to me is, you know, that's what this work is about, that's what this life is about, is finding those things that help to bring our daily life to somehow charge it, you know, to bring it alive. So that it's not just mundane for us. You know, we're not just going through the motions of life, but we find a richness, we find a connection, we find a meaning, and we find also something that we can share. You know, I think one of the things about you, you'll know this from going to concerts and so on, the fact that it's a shared experience makes it all the more beautiful.
Yeah. Well, Well, like I said, I can still clearly remember it. I was 17 at the time, so that's, blimey, 31 years ago now. And I can still remember there was one point where, for example, Springsteen was holding the mic up. No, they're doing a famous song. He's doing and all the crowd are singing. And I think there was 85,000 people there. And it was just going dark. And the lights were on the crowd at this point, and it seemed to me that everybody was in the same space that I felt I was in, and it was like, it was one of those, like I said, goosebump moments. It was just beautiful. And I think that's why a lot of people do enjoy concerts as well. They might not recognize that that's what's happening, but it does it. It brings them back to presence a lot of the time, because they, like you said, when you saw that stag, it knocks you out of your thinking, or what's keeping you, I can't think of a term to say that's keeping you down. It just like blows all that out of the water, and then what's there is there, and it's beautiful when people are in that zone, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think that, you know, the work that we do is, you know, it's a privilege for me, for us to be working in this field, because we're just using whatever means, you know, we can find, whether it's, you know, sharing the three principles or just sharing our own experience, really. I think really just reflecting back to people is the fact that this is, you know, it's equal for everyone. It's equally available for everyone. It's not something that is only available to the, you know, elite masters, as it were. I mean, they serve the function to mirror back to us. And they all say this, you know, it's within you, at least all the good ones. they all say, you know, don't follow me, don't look to me, it's within you. And it's, on the one hand, to me, it is funny that the examples that, you know, that we've been sharing, we could relate them all to a particular time and place and circumstance and event. But when you start to see the variety, you know, you realize, well, it wasn't just that. It wasn't that particular person. It wasn't that llama. It wasn't that particular musician or any of these kinds. They were each in their own unique way. They were each helping us to remember that which was in us all along.
I just had the image that then you're just like holding a mirror up to us, like that stag somehow held a mirror to you, and Christine held a mirror to me, George Best held a mirror to my friend. And
yeah, but there's, to me, there's like, I think in every aspect of life, there are, let's say, smaller ripples or smaller echoes of that same truth, which we could be noticing. And we do start to notice more and more. Like you were saying, you know, you read things now that you've maybe read before, and suddenly it comes to life for you in a new way. That's the same thing for me.
Yeah.
No, it's a book you've read maybe a dozen times, and you've got a certain thing out of it, and then all of a sudden, oh my God, how did I not see that?
Yeah. Well, I only have this with Sydney Banks. I've not watched, people who listen to these quite regularly, but Dickin advice, I mentioned to Dickin, I said, I've not listened to Sid for a while, because he read something out of Sid Banks' book, one of Sid Banks' books. And he said, you should go back to it. So I took his advice, and I was blown away by some of this stuff I've listened to dozens and dozens of times, but I've not listened to. And then it was like, wow, it was like I've never watched it before. It's so beautiful. So interesting.
It is lovely, but of course the peculiar thing is you could get so fired up from that, you know, you recommend it to your best friend or your next client, and they go, you know, they think you've lost your marbles. They read it, it just doesn't touch them at all. Exactly. And this to me is, you know, that's the magic piece. It's the mystical piece. It's so it has to be somehow uniquely crafted for each of us, you know. I call it resonance. There has to be a resonance. So, you know, people say to me, well, tell me, what did you read? You know, what was it? And I say, well, I can tell you, but really, it's what you read, you know, what you're drawn to.
Yeah.
You've got just as much chance as I have, you know, just pull a book off the shelf without thinking about it too much.
Yeah.
And let it fall open and see where your eye lands, you know?
Mm.
You've got a better chance than just following my recommendation, because you're listening to something then which, you know, it's your own wisdom. And the body, to me, embodies that wisdom. Mm. I've lost count of the number of times I've walked into bookshops and literally books have fallen off the shelf and hit me, you know. or I've been reaching for one and I've accidentally, so I thought, pulled out another. And it turns out the one I pull out, when I open it, it completely floors me. You know?
Yeah.
I've had this happen so many times. And I think, again, everybody has. But we can dismiss those things, or we can not pay attention to them. Or, you know, I think Carl Jung was onto something when, you know, he recognized this whole phenomena, which he named synchronicity.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, there was that recognition that, you know, you can call it just coincidence, or you can say, well, it's meaningful coincidence.
Yeah.
I think that's the way he put it, and I like that, you know, it's a meaningful coincidence when it resonates, basically, when it speaks to you.
Yeah. And
usually it's only for you in that moment.
Yeah. You could relate to somebody else, it'd be meaningless. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm just reminded, I mentioned this when I spoke to Muji about it. He recommended a book, The Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. And I said to him, I said, I can't read it for too much, because I open it and it like punches me in the face. It literally does it. It can be amazing that I'll be having some thoughts on reflecting on life or whatever. And I'll open the book wherever I'm going through the book, reading it systematically. You know, it's one of them books you start and finish. It's not just a reference book. And it's amazing how I open it and it seems to be speaking exactly to what I've been thinking about in that day.
Okay.
In such a powerful way. And I'm thinking, is this just coincidence? Or it seems almost mystical, you know, I can't believe it.
I read a lot of pages, I have to close it. So I've got this massive book, it's going to take me years to finish.
Yeah, I've had similar experiences with books. It's like I can just read like a couple of sentences, I have to go and lie down. You know?
And I could perhaps, like you said, I could perhaps go in and read it to Sheila, and it doesn't mean anything to her.
Not at all. But I think, you know, that to me, that's part of our message is, you know, if we're going to be successful in helping other people to touch that place within themselves so that it helps them, it helps bring them back to a place of connection with themselves and a place of truth and authenticity, then part of what we have to remind people is to follow their own instincts, follow their own wisdom, not listen to other people's advice and suggestions, and not get distracted by what everybody else is doing because it's tempting, you know.
Yeah, there's not a 5-step process to this.
And it takes us off the path, I think, you know, when we start following. And I love that Sid Banks was very emphatic about this point. You know, don't be a follower. He said you lose your dignity. You know, you give away your dignity and your freedom when you start following someone else. And to me that really resonated. You know, that really rang true for me because it's what I've found from my own experience. It's what I've stumbled upon.
Yeah.
That's for me has been the most helpful and the most powerful. So if in my own way I can help other people to stumble upon what they need to stumble on, then that to me is a better way to go about it than for me to kind of spoon feed them what has been helpful for me. And chances are it's not going to be good medicine for them.
Yeah. So it's, having said that, then it must be, it sounds like you've got you're doing exactly what you need to be doing. Then it sounds like your work have just given you a beautiful experience every day because you're just helping people in this point. Again, I'm trying to. You're good. It's always hard to. You can say the wrong words. It makes it like a doing kind of thing. But you're just helping people to recognize who and what they really are.
I hope so. I mean, as best I can, and. And in so doing, I get to remind myself, you know, they're not separate things. So to me, that's one of the real joys of this work is that I don't have a job and then I have a spiritual life. I have a spiritual job. And I think potentially any of us can have, you know, we can have that relationship with our work. If we're in right relationship with it, then anything can be an act of service and it can help, you know, to wake people up.
Yeah. Well, Ian, we're already gone over here. I'm very aware we've gone over here. Sorry about that. But
fine. I completely lost track of time there, as I do.
Well, I'm so looking forward to spending time with you here in Spain. So how do you see it panning out then, your little section in Spain? I guess you've not got too many, you're not pre-planning it in any way really.
Not yet, but what I tend to do, and I just did the same with this talk that I knew we were going to have, I feel like I just kind of open a space in my mind. I just open a space and I invite in whatever is ready to come in. And as I said to you before we started, just what was coming to me was something around this topic of presence. So that's what came in this time. I haven't opened the space yet for the Viva conference because I've got
you've got Egypt in between as well, haven't you?
Exactly. I've got a few other things on before that, so
you've got to keep them spaces clear.
it's going to have to wait, but I'm trusting. I've learned to trust this, that when you create a space, something always comes to fill it. So I can't tell you yet, Mark, what the exact title or topic will be, but. It will be, I imagine it will be a variation on this theme.
Yeah, lovely. Well, I'm looking forward to spending time with you, as I'm sure the people who are coming over are. There's a lot of people getting excited about it. So
it's going to be, I'm sure it's going to be a lovely gathering. It's going to be a lot of fun. And yeah, hopefully there'll be some wonderful sharing as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ian,
If people wanted to get in touch with you or come on one of your events, would you like to give your details out? Or
Have
you got anything going on in the UK or locally? Or well, like I said, I'm sure people could.
They can just look on the website, Mark. Yeah, the insightspace.com, and if they've got any particular questions or want to get in touch with me personally, just email me ian@theinsightspace.com.
Great, thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
No, it's been lovely chatting to you, and like I said, we'll chat again when you're here in Spain, and perhaps we'll do this again sometime.
Love to, Mark. Love to. I love what you're doing with these recordings. I love where it's going, and it's a great series that you've put together, I think.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that from coming from somebody like you. It's lovely. And like I say, I've just been, like you said, I'm just more and more, so I feel I'm doing what I'm doing with these. I create the space. I sometimes perhaps have one or two topics in mind before I start the conversations, but then I just tend to just see where it naturally unfolds. And it's interesting, the feedback you get. Sometimes it'll be something, one little remark that's been said by myself or my guest, and somebody, it'll blow somebody's socks off, you know, and I wasn't even aware of it at the time. So.
Well, keep doing what you're doing. It's great.
And you too.
So, thank you.
And if anybody wants to get in touch with me, they can. I've been having a few issues with my email address, so until I've sorted that out, people can contact me at satya.yoga@hotmail.com. And
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.